About the time you're walking out of a Chinese restaurant with the little white leftover boxes, you're not only feeling good, but wondering about the work that went into preparing that meal. I mean, lots of us can roast meat, whip up a vegetable dish, or make a salad. But Chinese food from our own kitchens? Yes, you can do it. And our guest this hour shows us how by demystifying Chinese cooking in the book Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees, Essential Techniques of Authentic Chinese Cooking. Qian Lam Ko lives in New York City, where he's a chef, instructor, restaurant consultant, and the blogger at redcook.net, for which he was nominated for a prestigious James Beard Award. He's also taught at the Institute of Culinary Education and at Brooklyn Kitchen. Qian Lam Ko, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you for having me here on the station.
So to what does the title refer, Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees?
Yes, that is a lot of the question that most people ask me. Phoenix claws actually represent chicken feet in Chinese, and jade trees represent the Chinese broccoli, and very often in Chinese menus, that's how they would be described as, like, for example, braised phoenix claws instead of braised chicken feet. So, you know, I decided to use the name because I feel like this is a way of imparting this idea of how the Chinese actually view food as being very poetic, very flowery, and it has a very mysterious kind of a aura to it. And by using that name, I hope to be able to then go on and demystify it after you've had like an interest in the title of the book.
The centrality of food to Chinese culture can't be overstated, I gather.
Absolutely. You know, I think one of the biggest misconceptions about Chinese food is the fact that, you know, the cooking technique and so on is just basically similar and with the, you know, our regular Western cooking. But it has a whole lot of very specific technique that actually is very closely related to the imperial kitchen earlier on during the development of the cuisine, and because of the fact that many of these dishes developed during the imperial period, then there's a lot of scholars, there's a lot of poets that is associated with helping to even produce the flavors, the idea of the dish itself, and naming the dishes. And this is why many of the Chinese dishes, if you look at some of the Chinese restaurant menu, they're very flowery, very poetic, and you know, it's very interesting. Yeah.
It really is, yeah. Some of the names on the menu, which, you know, makes me feel that much sadder when you go to an Asian restaurant. You just say, I like a number 19 or something.
That's right.
You want to be a little more poetic and appreciate the art that went into it. And Qian, were you driven to cooking by the state of Chinese restaurant food when you arrived in the United States?
Yes, I came to school in Boston University in the 70s, in 1970s. And, you know, during that time, the only Chinese food that you really can get are the chop suey and the chow mein, and so it was very disappointing for me, coming from a culinary kind of a household. We always have, you know, great food from our province, and so I miss all that good food. Although admittedly, many of the ingredients at that time was not even available, so it would not be possible to even reproduce many of the authentic dishes at that time. But what I did was, you know, I started writing home and asking my relatives for recipes, for the simple recipes, like simple braises, simple stir fries, and things like that. So that's how I got started. I really started cooking very simple dishes, and over the years, I do a lot more research, and I started cooking a lot more complicated dishes. And also, during this last 15 years or so, 15, 20 years, a lot more new Chinese ingredients are becoming available here in the United States. If you go to major cities, for example, New York, Chicago, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Los Angeles, you can actually find Asian market, Chinese market that carries a lot of the ingredients, and they are really good, authentic ingredients. So now it is possible to reproduce many of the real, authentic dishes from Asia, from China.
Right. So the ingredients are available. That's a good thing. The other one is the whole set of techniques and tools. I mean, is this as difficult as it can seem to be?
You know, it's only difficult if you make it difficult. Let me put it that way. Because I think of it as being understanding the theory behind it. If you understand why we do certain things, then you know, as you execute the dish, it would be natural because you know that these are the things that has to be done. For example, in a braised dish, you know, we. You know how in Western cooking, when you braise beef or lamb or something, you always sort of brown it first, right? You seal the meat, but you brown it before you add the liquid to braise. And there is a reason for that. You want it to seal the meat and make sure that all the juices doesn't come out and so on. And then as you cook it, infuse the whole meat and it's still moist. Now, the way that the Chinese do it is a little bit differently. And so we actually parboil instead of browning it and sealing the meat. We parboil the meat, and at the same time, when you are parboiling the meat, you know how there's a lot of impurities and scum float to the top, and you just scoop that off, and then when you finally put into the final liquid, it becomes a beautifully clear liquid at the end.
Wow, all kinds of great stuff to learn. A lot of time to do that. Our book is called Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees. It's a cookbook, but it's a lot more about technique than simple recipes. The recipes are there, too. Kian Lam co-wrote it. He's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and take your phone calls and emails for him when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Kian Lam Co. He is a chef. He's an instructor. He's a restaurant consultant and a blogger. And he's written a full cookbook demystifying Chinese cuisine. It's called Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees. We've already figured out Phoenix Claws are chicken feet, jade trees are Chinese broccoli. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we go through unveiling some of the mysteries of Chinese cookery so we can actually make it in our own kitchens. 800-838-3760 by phone around the region, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Now, by now, I'm sure a few people are thinking, you know, guys, Chinese cooking is multiple cuisines, and so does the book pretty much hit them all?
Well, okay, basically, the book really focuses on techniques, and many of these techniques are actually utilized in different regions of China. However, I have sections in the book that actually discuss the history and influences of the different regions and how the local ingredients and local herbs and spices influences the flavor of the dishes as well. So there is a whole section that really discuss different regions, but the recipes themselves, they are scattered all over. They are from all the different regions, and the purpose of the recipes really is to illustrate the techniques, and because that's what I wanted to emphasize on the book, and I feel that once you understand the technique, you'll be able to be innovative. You can be very creative and adapting to your own, local ingredients, or even put in some of the interesting flavors of your own. So, really, the book is a focus on technique, and that's why that's how the book is organized.
I'm a little surprised to find Richard Nixon in one of the historical sections, though. How did he get into your book?
Oh, yes, of course. That was in the 70s when Richard Nixon went into China and visit Beijing. The communist government actually throw him this incredible state banquet. And, if you look back at the menu at that time, it's really not that terribly exciting, but it was beautifully presented. And so, it was, I think Americans sort of have this like fascination at that time of Chinese food. And at the same time, that was during the time when Sichuan cooking and Hunan cooking was introduced into the American public. That's why there's a huge interest in that. I mentioned that incident simply because I think it's interesting to look at how Chinese food was brought into America and how it has changed the Chinese restaurant landscape here in America as well.
Has there been much tempering of tastes, though, as Sichuan and Hunan cuisine moved into American markets?
Yes.
So we don't get it as hot as it was served originally.
That is correct. Yes, and you know, unfortunately, that was during the 70s when you know all these regional cooking were introduced. They were introducing it into an audience that's still not very familiar with you know spicy food and exotic flavors. So most of the restaurants basically toned down their spices and also adapted to the local taste of, you know, a little bit more sweetness, a little bit more crunchy, a lot of deep frying dishes and such. So you're right, there is a lot of adaptation at that time. And it's not exactly the same as the original the Hunan or Sichuan cooking, but there is a little bit of that flavor to it. Now, recently, though, this last 10 years or so, there's a lot of new immigrants that are coming in from mainland China directly, and many of them are opening up very, very authentic Sichuan and Hunan cooking. So it is possible now to actually sample very authentic regional cooking in Los Angeles and New York, San Francisco. So you know, these are the major cities that you'll be able to sample them. But yeah, but you know, at the same time, though, I personally feel adaptation of Chinese food to local taste is natural. It's a it's a way of food evolving into the local taste. I think of so-called American Chinese food as being another regional Chinese cooking. That's how I see it.
Oh, okay.
And there's nothing wrong with it. And to be honest, every once in a while, I actually do crave for the sweet, crunchy General Cho's chicken.
It's funny. Which reminds me, when you were talking about sweetness, is that I guess I never stopped to think about the fact there really is no dessert per se, the way we think about it in America, in most of Chinese cuisine.
That is correct. That is correct. We do have sweet dishes, but in China, if you go to the more traditional restaurants or even in a household, the sweet dishes will be served along with the savory dishes. So there is no such idea of like an end of meal sweet dish. And usually at the end of the meal, we always serve fresh fruits, and that's the reason why you go to a Chinese restaurant, you always get oranges or cut up apples or something. But that's traditionally that is what we how we eat. However, you know, many of the more modern, more westernized restaurants in Asia now, they are beginning to serve sweet dishes at the end. And in accordance to you know the Western custom, so it's sort of like the Western influence into the modern dining custom of Asia, but yeah, traditionally we don't separate the sweet and the and that's why many of the items that I included in the book, the sweet dishes really are scattered throughout the book, and except for one chapter that I actually have a chapter on specifically on how the Chinese use sugar. We caramelize certain things. We use syrup on certain items, and so those are commonly used. Yeah.
The book is called Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees. The author is Qian Lam Ko, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. So on to the practices. What are some of the basic tools you'll need in the kitchen?
Actually, it's a very simple set of tools. Walk is the most important. So you do have to have wok. I would say that, you know, get a cover for the wok so that you'll be able to steam certain things in the wok. And it would also be nice to have a set of bamboo steamers to sit on the wok that you can steam some of the dishes. And then spatula, of course, you get like a flat one and probably also a one that looks like a ladle. And that's about it, basically, to really actually cook Chinese. Now, if you want to get into a little bit more, specific about it, like, for example, for cutting purposes and so on, you may want to get a cleaver, but usually a chef knife is sufficient to do the cutting and slicing for Chinese cooking. The cleaver is useful when you wanted to hack through the bone of, like, you know, chicken and things like, which is what we do a lot. Most of our, most of the Chinese dishes, when they call for, you know, a whole chicken, you would have to hack through the bone in order to serve it. You cook the whole chicken and then you cut into pieces before you serve it, or even in a braise, you know, you also braise chicken or you know, even pork sometimes with the bone attached to it. By the way, bones is a wonderful ingredient to add flavors to anything that you do. That's why we love to include bones in all our cooking. Bones actually, if you you know, if you cook in a liquid to make stock, you actually infuse some of the glutamate that comes out from the bone marrow and things like that. So we always try to include bones in our cooking simply because it actually adds natural MSG.
Ah, okay. So not the we'll ask about MSG a little further later on.
Right.
Back to the woks themselves. What are the best ones made from, and how are they best maintained?
Right. The best type of wok that I would recommend is to just use a basic, simple, you know, carbon steel iron. And these are just simple iron wok that you can buy in Chinatown. And then you have to season it. The reason is you want to season it so that it will keep it rust-free. And it will also maintain this certain, there will, you know, once you season it, it has a certain sort of flavor that remains in that wok. So when you buy a new wok, the best way to season it is to actually, well, first of all, you just rinse it quickly, and you may want to use a little bit of soap just to get rid of the machine oil that's used for the machining.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, you pour in a little bit of vegetable oil and heat it up in a wok, and then you start stir-frying some ginger, cut up a few pieces of ginger, and just keep stir-frying the ginger for like about 10-15 minutes. And that will start the seasoning process. Now, really, after you've done the seasoning, don't use soap to clean the wok ever again.
Never.
Never. I think that's the mistake of what a lot of people did, is that, you know, you use soap and it removes the oil layer, and of course the iron will rust. But if you keep the oil layer on the wok constantly, then you know it will protect the wok itself. So what you do is, after you've done your stir frying, use a brush, just brush off any food that gets stuck on the wok itself, rinse it thoroughly, wipe it dry, and then put it on a stove just to heat it up. That way you sort of sterilize whatever, you know, the wok, the wok itself. And then you can store it that way. Do it every time you cook. Now, if you're, one of the good thing about wok is you can use it for doing all kinds of stuff, not just stir fry. You can make braise in it. You can make soup in it. So if you, and of course you can steam by using a bamboo steamer on top of it. So if you have all, if you're doing that, it probably will remove some of the oil on the surface. So what you want to do is once you're done with steaming, let's say, you want to just quickly rinse it, and then also pour, like say, a teaspoonful of oil, and use a paper towel to just spread it all around, and that's it. Because you just wanted to cover a very thin layer of the oil, always. That way, your wok will last forever. I have this wok that's been that I've been using for 30 years.
And, wow!
And it is a wonderfully seasoned wok, and I have never have to replace it. So,
I'm glad you made it clear, though. You can use water, just not the soap.
Correct. Right. You do use water to clean it, but just don't use soap, because the soap basically removes the oil. And the idea is that you always want to have a thin layer of oil that covers the surface of the wok.
Qian Lam Ko is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is demystifying Chinese cooking for us. His book is called Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees. He talks about techniques over recipes. There are lots of recipes, though, too, and, of course, all the great pictures that tend to come with such cookbooks. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions and comments about Chinese cuisine. 800-838-3760 by phone, jx@jeffnet.org by email. Jamie in Medford, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, good morning, Jeffrey.
Hi.
Hi, sir. I have two questions. One question is kind of a trivia one. Do you know who Madame Sylvia Wu was?
I've heard the name. I believe she was...
West Coast cooker, and she cooked for celebrities and such like that.
Right. I remember she didn't she have like a Chinese cooking school or some cooking lessons in somewhere?
Okay,
yes,
so.
Possibly. But yeah. All I have is a paperback book, which has lots of recipes in it. But here's the second question to you: how do you properly prepare a dish which primarily is based of a bok choy? And I'll take the answer, Jeffrey, from the author off of the air. If I can.
Bok choy preparation. Okay, good
yes,
question there.
Okay, here's the thing about cooking leafy vegetables. In fact, I talked about it in the book, is that, with stir-frying, there are a few techniques. The most commonly known one, the one that in America that's familiar, is just like, you cut up pieces of ingredients, and then you put a little bit of flavoring sauces, and you get a dish, right? Now, but unfortunately, if one of your ingredients is a leafy vegetables, it will bleed a lot of liquid. At the end, when there's a lot of liquid, it dilutes all the flavors. So basically, the flavors sort of like get dispersed into the liquid. So we have a technique that is called simple stir frying, which basically is excellent for leafy vegetables like bok choy or spinach or water spinach like the Chinese water spinach. So napa cabbage. These are all the leafy vegetables that when you cook it bleeds liquid. So you only use one single ingredient in that case. That's why it's called simple stir fry. There's just one single ingredient for stir frying. And the only additional flavorings would be like, say, garlic. You would put garlic in as a flavoring and salt, and then season it with salt and pepper. Or sometimes, you also put in, shrimp paste as a flavoring agent. But rarely that we add a protein or any additional ingredients to go along with the leafy vegetables. Now, when you're saying, to cook bok choy, I would recommend that you basically just start by stir-frying some garlic, and you can put some ginger too if you want, that's as a aromatics, and just brown it a little bit. Don't burn it, just brown it, and then put the bok choy in. And when you get the bok choy in there, it will start, leak water out of that. So what you do is you cover it up with a wok cover. That basically sort of steam the vegetables as you are stir frying. So you cover it for like about 2 minutes, take it off, and continue stir frying, and then cover it again for another minute or so. By the end of that, you will actually have a dish that's just basically simple bok choy with garlic flavoring, and yes, there are liquid at the bottom, and that's part of the result of the dish itself.
And now, we talk about the stalky part of the bok choy or the leafy part?
Both. You cook both of them, and I would also recommend to first put in the stalk of the bok choy first to cook it a little bit longer, and then halfway through you can put in the leafy part of it. So regardless of how you do it, there's almost always there's like a little bit of liquid at the end. Now, some people just add in a little bit of starch slurry, meaning that you mix some, say, cornstarch or tapioca starch or potato starch, and mix some of the starch with like a little bit of water, and then just thicken the liquid that comes out from the stir frying. That is also another way of making sure that there's a bit of a thickening at the end. But it is very easy to just separate out the leafy vegetable, and then you can cook another stir fry dish with the protein and different type of vegetable. Now, if you wanted to do the regular stir fry, the vegetable should be sturdy. For example, a root vegetable, or let's say asparagus or string beans. Those are the kind of ingredients that do not bleed a lot of liquid. And so, and when you add sauces to that type of stir fry, then you'll be able to actually taste the flavor rather than get it all washed into this liquid.
The choice of what you're going to use to get started in the wok is critical, I would think. And there is a section about cooking fat. So what are some of the basics you think people need to get started?
Okay, the stir-frying technique requires very high temperature. And this is why that when you are choosing oil to use for stir-frying, it really should be oil that has high smoking temperature, because otherwise, you know, it will start burning the oil as you heat up the oil. I personally like to use vegetable oils, which is soybean oil, or, you know, canola is fine, and corn oil is fine. So depending on individuals, you know, health requirement and so on, and those are all, any kind of the vegetable oil is good. Although traditionally, we always use lard for, you know, stir fry. That is the original fat that we use. But yes, it is possible to just pick some vegetable oil.
All right, lard. Didn't realize that was part of the mix. Welcome back and talk more with Kian Lam Ko. His excellent book on cooking techniques in Chinese cuisine, Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees, back on the Jefferson Exchange with our guest and with your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about Chinese cuisine today and how we can prepare it ourselves. Chinese cooking is demystified by the author, chef, and blogger Kian Lam Ko in his book Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees, the references to chicken feet and Chinese broccoli. You can join us. We demystified already. You can join us on the exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Lots of comments and questions coming in, or you can join us by email jx@jeffnet.org. Let's go to Daniel in Arcata. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kian Lam Ko.
Hey, how's it going, you guys? I love your show so far. I'm interested in the fundamentals of sauces. It's always the thing that's most challenging with Chinese food with me. In particular, I like the Hunan hot and spicy sauces, but I just was interested in what the essential ingredients are for the delicious sauces of Chinese food.
All right. Thanks for that, Daniel. Appreciate it.
Okay. In Chinese cooking technique, there is really only one technique that uses sauces, which is what we're all familiar with, like, for example, sweet and sour and General Cho's chicken and things like that. All the other techniques, basically, we do not, quote-unquote, create sauces. All the other techniques, basically, the sauce or the gravy at the end are from the cooking itself. Like in a braise, you get the braising liquid that becomes the sauce at the end, or when you steam something, the steamed liquid becomes the sauce at the end. So, but yes, there is one technique which in Mandarin is pronounced as liu, and this particular technique, you can either deep fry your protein or your basic ingredients, or you can actually steam it, or you can boil it before putting sauces on it. Now, Chinese sauces are very regional. I would say that in the eastern and northern part of China, most of the sauces probably will be based on soy sauce or vinegar and with aromatics like ginger and garlic and wine, plus wine extracts. You know, those are the kind of flavoring profile that you would get from the northern Chinese cooking. But then when you go to the south, it becomes a lot more complicated. For example, in Sichuan cooking, you will have many different ways of making sauces. There's a mala sauce, which mala actually is a Mandarin term for meaning that it's numbing and spicy heat. So, which is a combination of Sichuan peppercorn and chili pepper. So those two flavors is an iconic Sichuan flavor. So there are sauces that you use the Sichuan peppercorn and the chili to create the sauce with additional aromatics, for example, ginger and garlics, and then you add some soy sauce and vinegar to balance the flavor. So that's one other kind of sauce. And then also there's bean paste sauce. So there throughout the South, there are many varieties of bean paste, so you will end up having like some sauces that has this slightly fermented flavor, slightly salty kind of a flavor, and it's and lots of umami, and it's a wonderful way of creating sauces. And then on the coastal region in southern China, there are dishes that's made from wine lees, which wine lees are the residue of the of winemaking process. For example, if you're making rice wine, the rice itself after fermentation and the wine has been removed, there's a whole set of the residue, and that actually has incredible umami and has a lot of this wine fermented kind of a taste. And in southern coast region, they actually use that to make sauces as well. So there are many different ways of making sauces, in other words, but and it is quite regional. But the ones that were most commonly associated here in the United States, I think most people are familiar with, is the two kinds, which is one is hoisin sauce base. You know, hoisin sauce is a kind of dark brown bean based sauce, and it's slightly sweet, and it's often used for to dress like a cut up pieces of chicken and vegetables. And the other one, that's the Cantonese sauce, which is the oyster sauce base sauce. And the oyster sauce itself has very strong kind of seafood kind of flavor to it, and salty. But it has lots of umami. That's why a lot of people like to use it, because it creates some wonderful tasting flavor. So those are some the basic of sauces in China, I would say.
Wow, in a nutshell.
Right.
Boyd in Wolf Creek writes in asking about ginger root. He asks, what are the best, most flavorful sources of fresh ginger root? He says, Peru, Hawaii, and the U.S. seem to be the most consistent organic sources and sometimes have a particularly bright yellow color. And what are the best techniques for using fresh ginger?
Okay. I mean, to be very honest, I'm not that familiar with the Peruvian ginger or so, but the common ginger that is available here in the U.S. Is quite sort of fatty roots, and it's like a light yellow kind of color. And that one actually is quite good, which I use. It's available very commonly. It's American ginger, I believe. But the Asian type, which is a little bit more knobby, and the root itself is a more beige color, so it's a lighter color than the yellow. That has a really nice, strong flavor, and I actually also like to use it, except that's not available readily. You know, it's only seasonally. Sometimes I see it in Chinatown market, but not very common. And so those are the ginger that I'm familiar with. But how to use it? The best way to peel a ginger is to actually use a spoon. Like take a tablespoon and just scrape the skin off, mm-hmm. and it comes right off. I really like that way of peeling it, because then you don't lose too much of the root itself. You're just basically scraping off the thin layer of skin.
And then do you grate it or slice it?
It depends on the recipe. It really depends on the recipe. Some recipes call for slices, and some recipe calls for mince. And we don't really grate ginger as in Chinese cooking. We mostly just mince and slice. And also we sometimes julienne it very, very thinly. Those are usually used as a garnish. For example, to garnish steamed fish, or you garnish a sauce for, dumplings. And so it really depends on the recipe. And also if you're doing braising, what you do is you can actually just take an unpeeled ginger and just like use the blade of the knife and just like crush it, because that way it crushed open the juices in the ginger, and yet it's still a chunk. So that way at the end of braising you can take the chunk of the ginger out.
Ah, similar technique for garlic, it sounds like, for smashing it
with
the side of the blade. Okay.
Correct.
Another call here from Jacob in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kian Lam Ko, the author of Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees.
Hi, I want to talk about the secret ingredient of Chinese cooking. And I think you mentioned it, unani, and they also use the term monosodium glutamate. But it's an interesting concept, because in this country, there's been an evolving relationship with it. In the 70s, someone published an article in the New England Journal of Medicine regarding, they called it Chinese restaurant syndrome, meaning
right.
After he went to a Chinese restaurant, he got sweaty and a headache and felt groggy.
Yeah, it's actually quoted in the book.
Right.
Yeah, and then people called monosodium glutamate a villain. You know, they called lumped it along with pesticides and non-organic foods. But in reality, in the past like decade, they've evolved the understanding of it through both culinary science and sensory science perception, and they actually found there was a receptor on the tongue that's the fifth taste.
Right.
You know, sweet, sour, bitter, and salty. And then the fifth taste is umami taste. And there's actually a receptor on the tongue for monosodium glutamate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually a key to understanding, you know, that taste of a good broth or, you know, a meaty sensation that's inherent to human taste sensation. So it went from being a pathology and a red flag to actually being essential to any type of, like, savory cooking.
Correct.
All right. Thanks for that, Jake. Appreciate it. So you mentioned umami a couple times now. Is it related to MSG and its use?
Right. So here's the, you know, the term umami, which has been known for to Asian, I mean, in Chinese, actually, there's a word, there's a character that's called xian, and xian is it's the same meaning as umami. It's like, so it really produces this savory taste in the food, and you know, we've all know about adding stock and enrich your flavors with your dishes with like rich stocks and such. And nobody knows why that is the case until a professor in Japan actually discovered this. And this is, you know, it refers to what the listener was saying about how there's a specific receptor in your mouth that actually distinguish this flavor. And so, MSG itself was developed to and extracted out from seaweed, so it really is actually a natural chemical that's in a seaweed. It's just that it's been extracted out, and that was it was developed in the 50s. And personally, I don't object to artificial MSG. All these flavors actually come from many different kinds of glutamate, and MSG is just one of them. And all these glutamates actually exist naturally in many different products. So, for example, mushroom actually has a large quantity of MSG. Any kind of fermentation, once you've fermented fish or you've fermented beans, you know, that's why soy sauce all has this glutamate flavor in it. So that's the reason why, you know, people love to put soy sauce, because it has such a wonderful flavor. So really they're all natural, but unfortunately, because of that article in the New England Journal of Medicine, I believe it was in the early 60s, it sort of demonized the Chinese restaurant food because of this particular letter to the editor that was published in the journal, and since then there's been all kinds of tests trying to prove whether there was a side effect or not, and nobody was actually able to really correlate the symptom to MSG. Now, granted, if you eat a lot of MSG, you know, it's similar to like eating a lot of salt. You'll get this very thirsty kind of a feeling, and you know, it has a very specific kind of a reaction, but it's not if you're just consuming it at a very regular level. And this is why most modern writers are saying that, you know, really MSG really is not such a bad product after all. But yet at the same time, personally for my cooking, I prefer to actually add my natural MSG through stocks and braising and keeping bones in the braises and so on. And that's how I usually would prefer to do to provide the MSG itself.
Before we go, I got a couple questions about stir frying, because you mentioned several different types. I'm curious to know about how you do a dry stir fry, and then after that, what you do with the leftover oil when you're done with all your work on the wok.
Right. Okay. You know, the basic stir fry technique is to first par cook the protein. And par cooking the protein, usually you would cook it through a bit of oil. I mean, a good quantity of oil. Let me put it there. You don't fry it basically, but you sort of like almost like poaching it in oil. And then after you've poached it in oil, then you remove all those oil that is used for poaching, and then leave about 2 tablespoons in the wok, and then add the aromatic ingredients, ginger, scallion, and so on, and then you then cook whatever vegetables that you're going to accompany the meat. Now at that point, the vegetable will be quickly stir-fried and cooked to the almost al dente, and then you bring the protein back into the wok. And finally, just before serving, that's when you add your flavoring ingredients, like, you know, any kind of soy sauce, any kind of bean sauce, any kind of, whatever sauce that you wanted to put in. Now, there are two kinds of stir-frying. One, I call it dry stir-fry and moist stir-fry. The dry stir-fry, the sauce is very minimal. You just have it cooked so that it'll coat the ingredients. Mm-hmm. However, with the moist stir fry, you actually add extra stock and extra liquid to give it a little bit of gravy at the end.
So, okay, a really big difference then in what you're adding to the wok as you go through. There's
right.
just so much material that we're not going to have time to get to. The book is called Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees, Essential Techniques of Authentic Chinese Cooking, put together by Qian Lam Ko. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.